Miramax Films presents a film colony production. Johnny Depp, Kate Winslet, Julie Christie, Rhoda Mitchell, and Dustin Hoffman. Based upon a play, The Man Who Was Peter Pan, by Alan Nee. And inspired by true events.
I love opening nights.
A party of theatergoers.
How are you? Good to see you.
Good evening, Charles.
Herbert, how are you?
This is my wife.
Oh, Lady Herbert.
How do you do?
May I give you a pat?
One of Mr. Barry's finest?
Oh, that genius Gluskin has done it again. It's the best thing I've produced in 25 years.
Really?
I already have investors interested back home in New York.
See you on Broadway.
The jovial American producer greets the arriving audience on the steps of his theatre in Finding Neverland. Backstage, a slim, dark-haired man slides a mirror on a rod through a gap in the plush velvet curtains and spies on the audience as they settle in their seats.
First position, people! Standing by, please. Ladies and gentlemen, if you could take your opening positions, please.
On stage, lights come up and the actors assemble.
Beginners, please take your opening positions. Audience, you're coming in. Standing by.
A uniformed usher comes past the man with the mirror backstage.
Good audience.
Sorry?
Good audience. Tonight.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. How much longer?
10 minutes.
At the theatre entrance.
I love opening night. I want to dance with your wife at the after party. Oh, my goodness.
Good evening, Mr. Trump.
How are you, John?
Very well.
It's the best thing that I've produced in 25 years. Hello, George. How are you?
Wealthy, I see.
You rearranged a holiday for me and I won't forget.
You, Charles.
Won't regret it.
I'm sure.
Have you got the tickets?
Yes, it's in my pocket.
There's Mrs. Baring.
Oh, Mrs. Sir, we were so hoping to speak with your husband before the show.
Have you seen him?
I'm not sure where he is, actually.
Mrs. Barry smiles awkwardly at the eager elderly couple in evening dress. In a corridor between the stalls and the stage, her husband, the dark-haired man with the mirror, again nervously parts the velvet drapes to peep out at the audience. In the pit, the orchestra play while the elderly couple follow Mrs. Barry into the auditorium.
We do miss seeing you on stage. You were so wonderful.
Yes, well, it's been some time now. Are you right to find your seat?
Oh, yes, yes. See you at the party, then.
Excuse me, could you find Mr. Barry and remind him that they're doing his play this evening?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
The usher hurries away. Mrs. Barry, in a black and silver sequined evening gown and long white gloves, her blonde hair pinned up above a delicate, high-cheekboned face, makes her way to a private box. Her husband, tapping his cane in agitation, glances backstage, then again peeps into the auditorium. At the entrance to the main foyer, Charles Frohman, the producer, turns to the doorman.
Let's close the doors.
A stage electrician cranks the control wheels of the lighting board, bringing up all the lights. In the auditorium, the conductor with baton raised leads the orchestra to a finish. Curtain rises. It is London, 1903. On stage, a white-haired man in a long black coat and skull cap stands behind the counter of a dingy office. A fire burns in the grate, and artificial rain drips down the windows as he opens the door to a visitor in a frock coat who removes his top hat with a theatrical flourish. As the actor begins speaking, James Barry watches through the curtains. The uniformed usher pads up silently behind him.
Really, I mustn't inconvenience you in this way. I can wait quite well in the shop.
It is no inconvenience. The shop is chilly. And there is a fire here.
Well, you are uncommonly good.
Sorry, sir. Mrs. Barry wanted me to remind you that the play has begun. Though I imagine you know that.
Peter.
Sir?
It's like a dentist's office out there. Why?
I wouldn't say that I hate it, sir.
What do you think? Do you like it?
The usher squirms awkwardly.
I've just been hired here, sir.
Yes or no, I'm not bothered.
Are you not really qualified to...
Do you like it? Is it crap?
Crap, sir?
Go on, see it. Just see it. It's shite, isn't it? Go on. See it.
Don't know if I'm...
It's bull's pizzle, Mr. Barry. Go on, see it.
It's bull's pizzle, Mr. Barry.
I knew it.
No, I haven't even seen it.
I knew it. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Barry in white tie and tails tips the flustered young usher and turns back to study the audience.
Might I look at you, Malloy, for a moment?
They're fidgeting in their seats.
I'm an old man.
One military-looking gentleman is fast asleep. As Barry watches, lightning flashes, and as if in a dream, the stage rain spreads from behind the set out into the auditorium, soaking the bored audience. After the performance, Charles Frohman, the producer, and James Barry, the author, mingle with guests and friends.
Absolute rubbish from start to finish.
Yes, I found it fearfully dull.
Say goodbye to your investment, old boy.
Good to see you. My apologies, I...
We'll get them with the next one, Charles, I promise.
Of course we will, James.
I know you put a lot into this one.
A fortune, James, but I'm fortunate because I can afford to lose a fortune.
Can you?
No, I can't. How are you?
Arthur.
James, we sorely missed at the last club meeting.
Was I?
We were beginning to wonder which is your hobby, writing or cricket.
You don't see.
You wanted to speak with Mr. Barry, didn't you?
Oh, yes, but we shouldn't interrupt them, should we?
I don't see why not.
Yeah, if you ask me, the problem lies in our batting order.
Absolutely right.
James.
Oh, darling.
You remember Mr. and Mrs. Snow, don't you?
Mrs. Snow.
Mr. Barry.
Mr. Snow.
So the Snows have been waiting to meet with you all evening.
Oh, yes.
Is that right?
Your play this evening. It was remarkable, wasn't it?
Barry raises his eyebrows.
Was it? Well, thank you. That's very kind of you. I'm glad you liked it.
Stumped for words, he lowers his eyes.
How did you feel it went?
I think I can do better.
Really?
A housemaid carefully cuts a review headed Mr. Barry's play fails to impress out of the morning paper. She glances up at the bell and carefully folds the newspaper. Above stairs, Barry steps out of his room.
Mary, hello?
Yes, James?
I'm headed off for the park if you'd like to join me. It's a beautiful morning.
You'll be working, won't you?
Perhaps, yes.
I'll let you to your work then.
As he walks downstairs carrying a leather-bound writing book, the maid appears with a newspaper, and with Portos, a brown and white Newfoundland dog, on a lead.
Morning, Emma.
She hands him the paper, the dog, and a fishing rod in a canvas sleeve.
Have a good day, sir.
And you.
In the park, he casts a rubber ball attached to the fishing rod.
That's right. Good boy. Grab it. Good.
Children point in amazement as Barry reels in the Newfoundland, who clutches the red ball between its teeth. Barry ambles on through the park, reading from his notebook, the dog by his side. Couples stroll beneath the trees, and nannies pass by pushing perambulators. Barry sits on a park bench and unfolds the paper. There's a large hole in the middle of the page where Emma the maid has cut out the offending review. Through the hole, he sees a young woman in a white ensemble petting his dog. He watches the woman with two of her young children.
Excuse me, sir. You're standing on my sleeve.
Am I? So sorry.
Barry peers down.
I might point out you're lying under my bench.
I have to, I'm afraid. I've been put in a dungeon by the evil Prince George. I'm sorry if it bothers you.
Well, if you're trapped in the dungeon, there isn't much to be done there, is there? Perhaps I could slide a key to you through the bars.
I wouldn't risk it, sir. The evil Prince George has tortured many men.
I'm sorry, is he bothering you, sir? My brother can be an extremely irritating sort of person.
Prince George, I gather. I understand you were the horrible tyrant who imprisoned this unfortunate wretch.
Not horrible, really, but a firm ruler, yes. Kind and tolerant.
And what precisely is, what did you say your name was?
Michael.
What precisely is Michael's crime?
He's my younger brother.
Ah, fair enough. Sorry, lad. Cannot free you.
That's all right.
A third boy.
Do you mind playing with your dog?
No, go on.
This is Jack, second in line to the throne.
Good dog.
And that one's Michael. He's only five.
And I'm in prison for it.
Their mother.
So sorry, my boy's bothering you.
We're not bothering him, Mum.
Michael, darling, come out from under there.
I can't. I'm in prison.
Oh, I see.
Jay and Barry. Pleased to meet you.
Jay and Barry, the author. A pleasure. Sylvia Llewellyn Davies.
You're a writer?
I am.
He's a playwright, Jack. Quite a famous one at that. I apologise, I imagine you're writing.
No, not so.
Where's Peter?
What have you written, Mr. Barry?
Well, currently, I make my living entertaining princes and their courts with my trained bear Porthos. If you command your brother Peter to join us, I am willing, Prince George, to give you just such a performance in exchange for the freedom of this prisoner, of course.
Very well.
Very well. Now,
he peers at Portos.
I want you to pay particular attention to the teeth.
Sylvia and her four boys sit on a rug watching.
Some unscrupulous trainers will show you a bear whose teeth have all been pulled, while other cowards will force the brute into a muzzle. Only the true master would attempt these tricks without either measure of safety.
Peter, the third youngest boy, turns to his mother.
What did you bring me over here for?
Peter.
For this is absurd, it's just a dog.
Barry spins round.
Come on, Dad.
And advances on Peter.
Just a dog? Just? Porthos, don't listen to him. Porthos dreams of being a bear, and you want to dash those dreams by saying he's just a dog? What a horrible candle-snuffing word. That's like saying he can't climb that mountain, he's just a man. Well, that's not a diamond. It's just a rock.
With a reproving look.
Just.
He straightens up. Peter watches him, undaunted.
Fine, then. Turn him into a bear. If he can.
Peter, where are your manners?
With those eyes, my bonny lad, I'm afraid you'd never see it. However, with just a wee bit of imagination, I can turn around right now and see the great bear, Porthos.
Dance with me.
The long-haired Newfoundland puts its front paws on Barry's shoulders and they dance. The scene cuts back and forth between the park and a small circus ring, where Barry, in a red ringmaster's coat and handlebar moustache, horses with someone in a bear costume. In the park, the boys, dressed in identical tunics, floppy collars, knee breeches, and long black socks, watch with rapt attention. In the circus ring, a chorus of sad-faced clowns, harlequins, and pierrots rise up to join in the dreamlike dance. As the clowns with their solemn, white-painted faces pirouette, the circus ring changes into a palace of mirrors, festooned with chandeliers and fairy lights, stretching away to infinity. In the middle of it all, the ringmaster dances with the bear. In the park, Barry trips over Porthos and falls down. He bows to the four children and their mother.
Well, thank you. I don't think I've ever seen a performance quite like it.
We're here every day, and the bear is always more than happy to perform.
Well, perhaps we'll see you here tomorrow, then.
Perhaps.
Sylvia folds their rug.
Just jump up, please, darling, quick.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Peter, didn't you enjoy that?
I've seen better.
At dinner.
Well, Michael wanted the bear kept prisoner with him, and Peter insisted that Michael was hardly a prisoner, and Porthos simply wasn't a bear at all. I do very much hope to see them tomorrow.
What's her name?
Sylvia. Mrs. Something Davies.
Mary looks up sharply.
Llewellyn Davies.
You know her?
Well, I know who she is, of course. Why, she's a de Maurier, for heaven's sake. Her father was the artist. Her brother's the actor. And there was something tragic that happened with her husband. Oh, yes. He died. Cancer of the jaw, I believe.
That's horrible.
Yes, apparently he left her with four boys and no income to speak of. If it wasn't for her mother's help.
She sips her wine thoughtfully.
James. We should have them to dinner.
Should we?
Absolutely. I've always wanted to meet Madame de Maurier. Why, she knows practically everyone there is worth knowing.
Barry raises his eyebrows indifferently. The following day, he sits on the same park bench dressed in a dark suit and a floppy white sun hat, writing in his leather-bound journal. Porthos sits beside him. Peter walks down the gravel path towards him.
What are you writing about?
Oh, nothing of any great consequence.
I can't write.
Have you ever kept a journal? Ever tried your hand at writing a play?
The boy shakes his head.
Well, then how do you know?
I know. That's wrong.
I see. Where's your mother today and the rest of the boys?
Home. Mother's got a bit of a chest cold. I'm sure everyone would be happy to see you, though. One afternoon.
They study each other solemnly.
I should leave you to your writing.
The boy turns and walks away, and James watches him go.
Peter! See you later, then.
Peter nods and continues on his way. Later, Barry stands with Charles Frohman outside the theatre. A stagehands take out the dismantled set.
Why didn't you tell me, Charles? I knew it wasn't any good.
Why didn't you tell me, James? You knew it wasn't any good. I took an extended lease on the theatre, keeping the actors on.
I don't have another play.
I'm sure you will.
James Barry turns away and goes into the theatre.
Won't you?
We'll see.
I need you to sign for the storage, Mr. Frohman.
Frohman signs for the set and follows Barry into the auditorium. He sits in the stalls across the aisle from Barry, both facing front.
He's never meant to be taken seriously.
You know what happened, James? They changed it.
They changed what?
The critics. They made it important.
Frohman turns to look at Barry.
What's it called?
Barry's eyes swivel round to meet his inquiring look.
What's it called?
Play.
Play.
A rough-hewn sign on a Wild West street says Great Ormond Mining Company. Barry, with a feather in his headband, fights Sylvia's four boys, all dressed as cowboys. As they play, the scene changes between the Wild West town and the children's back garden.
Nasty Indian.
Our people teach boy Indian ways, make him great warrior. Our chief, Running Nose, never let him go.
Bang, bang, bang!
Sylvia chuckles as Barry pretends to be shot.
Me wounded, Peter. Time short. You go. Spread wings and soar like eagle above enemy. Fly back to our chief. Tell her of my brave defeat.
That's crazy. Indians can't fly.
Of course they can. Go on, go on, go on.
Listen to us, boy. This engine kidnapped you.
Not true. We kidnapped no one. You lost the boy. I teach you ways of the brave. I take you as my own son.
You are not my father.
Peter hurries away.
Bang, 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 bang.
Jack
bang,
grabs Peter.
Bang. Let me go!
Stop it, you two.
Oh, we are awful, aren't we?
I'm warning you.
Oh, I'm scared. We can have a bit of fun for a change.
Stop it, you two.
Don't.
Get off!
Stop.
Jack, come on.
Peter runs past his mother into the house. Later.
I'm terribly sorry.
Oh, it wasn't your fault.
I'm afraid it might have been.
To be honest, I'm just happy you got him to join in the game.
Oh, yes, I was a tremendous success.
Mr. Barry, it's more than I've been able to achieve.
Barry scoops up toys.
He's a different boy since his father died.
As they head back to the house.
No, I don't think he's even had a good cry about it.
Well, grief affects us all in different ways, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Oh, by the way, my wife would like to invite you and the boys over to dinner. Your mother as well.
Sylvia shuts the French windows.
Oh. How kind. That would be lovely.
At the Barrys.
Well, don't you all look lovely in your little suits? And Mrs. de Maria, what a shame it is that we've not met until this evening. How kind of you to say so. Not at all. I can't tell you how many times I've been to a charity or a social event and seen your name listed among the organisers.
Barry pretends to drop off.
It's the very thing I would love to do myself if I could just find the time.
My problem is in finding the time to do everything else. At the moment, I am running two households. Sylvia believes she can get by without a housekeeper.
Mother.
My house is quite large enough for us all. The idea of living with me seems not...
Not now, please, Mother.
We help her keep the house in order.
Don't interrupt, George. Where did you get your manners?
Sorry, Mother.
Well, Mr. Barry, I understand you've become playmates of my grandchildren.
Oh, they indulge me, really.
Mrs. de Maria nods loftily.
On the contrary. The other day we took to an exploration of darkest Africa in our garden. But, Mr. Barry was... taken ill by the bite of a... what was it?
Tsetse fly. Quite horrible.
Yes, and he swelled to the size of a hippopotamus.
Fingers like sausages.
I had to float him down the river like he was a great bloated raft.
But the fishing was good, wasn't it?
Barry breathes on a spoon and hangs it from his nose.
James.
Mary gives him a warning look as the four boys copy him.
Please.
Bye.
Good night.
Good night.
Mary's social smile fades as she closes the door.
Well, that was a disaster.
Outside on the street.
Painful. Utterly painful to see. I don't know what you mean. I had a lovely time.
Indoors.
Oh, James, please. My problem is in finding the time to do everything else. I've never felt so judged in my life.
Judged? What do you mean?
A grown man, for heaven's sake, playing all day long with children.
In any case, I hardly think there'll be the social contact we'd hoped for.
I haven't really thought of them that way. Just enjoy their company.
He's being a good friend to us, Mother. Yes, but what does that mean? Surely you don't intend to keep spending your afternoons with those children, do you?
The Barrys go off into their separate rooms. On another day, in the shade of a tree on a grassy slope, Barry holds up a kite.
So today, ladies and gentlemen, using only the wind and his own physical strength, George Llewellyn Davies shall test the very limits of the atmosphere using his tethered craft. Go on, boy.
Go on, George.
You're going to break it, George.
George, stop.
Just need a bit more speed.
I want to do it.
Hold off a bit, George. I think it's in need of a tail.
Oh, wait.
Sylvia fetches her scarf.
Here, James, this will do.
That's a good idea.
No, he's not heavy enough.
I want to do it.
You're coming, Peter.
Peter reluctantly follows.
Porthos.
You'll work this time.
Porthos, give us your bill. That's good. Here, like that. Michael?
Yeah?
Now, would you like to give it a go?
Yes, please.
Would you?
Oh, he can't run fast enough.
Of course he can.
Let him try, Jack.
Now, George, you hold the kite.
George? Come on, boys, let's go back up to the top. Michael,
come on.
Come on, Peter. Right, George, hold it up. Darling, you've got to run now. Ready? Ready? Run!
Run, Michael! Run!
Oh.
Oh, I told you this wasn't going to work. I don't think he's fast enough.
It's not going to work if no one believes in him.
No, give him a chance.
Michael, go back to your starting position.
Come on, darling, try
George,
again.
You take the kite.
If it'll help.
Now, this time, I don't want a flea's breath of doubt. We must get that kite in the air.
All right, look, I think I feel a bit more breeze. Are you ready,
go
Michael?
On, go on.
All right,
you
darling,
can do it, Michael.
You've
Michael.
Got to
hold
run.
It tight.
Run, Michael, run.
Run! Run!
That's it.
Yay!
As 5-year-old Michael belts downhill in his red sailor jacket, the kite soars into the sky, trailing Sylvia's scarf at the tail, with a bell from Porthos's collar dangling at the end of it. Later, the boys and Sylvia picnic in the long grass under a tree. Barry sits further off across the park in the shade of another tree, resting a sheet of paper on a book on his knee and writing with a scratchy fountain pen. Peter detaches himself from his mother and brothers and wades through the summer grass towards him. He cocks his head to one side to see what Barry is scribbling.
What are you writing about now?
Oh, just making notes. I'm never really certain what they're about until I've read them over later.
Something about the kite?
Now, why do you ask that?
I don't know. If I were a writer, I think I could tell a whole story about flying the kite today.
Perhaps you should then. That's a fantastic idea. Why not give it a try?
Jack.
I hope you haven't been talking about anything too serious with this one.
No. Talking a bit of silliness, really.
Peter gives Barry a secretive wink and turns away. Barry watches thoughtfully as the brothers go off. Later, they all walk up the path to Sylvia's house.
Can we have him for supper?
Have him to stay for supper, Michael. We're not cannibals. You are welcome, you know.
Mrs. DeMaria opens the door.
Sylvia. Mr. Barry. Where have you been?
Flying a kite, Mother, and having a wonderful time. I'm sorry, I didn't know you were coming this evening.
No? Well, apparently you forgot, then. I brought some supper along for us all.
You didn't need to do that.
Well, there's no food in the house, is there? Really, you don't need to wait till the cupboard is bare.
Please, Mother. Come on, darling.
Wipe feet. There's been enough fracking round here. George, I thought you said you were going to help your mother take care of the house. A coat, Michael, please. Yes, and coat hanger. Very good.
Will we see you tomorrow?
No, you're going to be helping around the house tomorrow.
Mother, there is absolutely no need for this.
You can't do everything yourself. Look at you. You're horribly flush. You're wearing yourself out.
Thank you for a lovely day, James. Excuse me, Mother.
So, from tomorrow, we're going to have some discipline around here.
And not one of you will escape.
Mrs. Dumaria waves a coat hanger at the boys. Barry imagines it as the hook of a false hand.
Good evening, Mr. Barry.
Good evening, Sarah.
Good evening, Mr. Barry.
Good evening, Emma.
At home, he puts his stick in the hall stand, while the maids Emma and Sarah go into the dining room to tidy up. Mary appears at the top of the stairs in a sleeveless blue gown.
You missed supper.
Perhaps I'll have something later. I have a bit of writing I wanted to do.
Are you sure? It was a lovely meal. Duck. Sarah let Emma cook this evening.
Is that right? Listen, what would you think of loaning Emma out to the Davies for the occasional evening? They don't actually have a cook.
I take it Mrs. Davies enjoyed the meal she had here.
Barry shrugs innocently.
Imagine she could use an extra hand now and again, that's all.
Oh. That's very charitable of you.
Mary comes downstairs.
Perhaps we can send over some of the silver as well. And what about linen? I wouldn't be surprised if some of hers was looking a bit shabby.
Please, Mary, stop.
Maybe she can send over some of the things we've run short on. My husband, for example. We rarely see him in this house.
That hasn't seemed to bother you for some time now.
Mary looks in the direction of the dining room with a pained expression. Sarah and Emma scurry down the hall. Later in his room, Barry plays chess with himself, swapping seats between each move, and writes at length in his journal. At Charles Frohman's theatre, Michael steps onto the stage, flanked by two of his older brothers. All three wear their tunic suits, breeches and long socks. But Michael wears a crown and carries an orb and scepter, and George and Jack carry wooden swords. As Michael hoists himself up into an enormous gold and red throne, Barry and Peter watch from the empty dress circle.
Lords and ladies, His Royal Highness King Michael the Benevolent, protector of the realm.
That scepter's made of wood.
Yes, well, we dream on a budget here, don't we?
No, I mean, everyone thinks it's made of gold, but it's just an old hunk of wood.
The means to an end, Peter. What we've done is taken an old hunk of wood and transformed it for all the world to see into the most magnificent gold.
Barry hands Peter a book.
What's this?
All great writers begin with a good leather binding and a respectable title. Open it.
Peter opens the leather-bound journal and reads.
The Boy Castaways, being a record of the terrible adventures of the brothers Davies, faithfully set forth by Peter Lewin and Davies.
Kipling would swallow his own ear for a title like that.
Stab him, George! You can do it! I still have no idea what to write.
Write about anything. Write about your family. Write about the talking whale.
What whale?
The one that's trapped in your imagination and desperate to get out. Come sit down.
They sit side by side in the dress circle.
I have actually begun writing about the adventures of the Davies brothers myself.
A play?
A play indeed, yes. And I would be extremely honoured if you would allow me the use of your name for one of the characters.
Peter grins and shakes his head.
I don't know what to say.
Say yes.
Peter nods.
Good man.
Let's go! Let's go! I won't go to bed, though, won't I? Won't
you? Oh, you could have been in bed half an hour ago, young man.
I'm afraid I've grown hopelessly lax in my discipline.
Nonsense. Young boys should never be sent to bed. They always wake up a day older. And then before you know it, they're grown.
Their father would have been horrified. Of course, he'd never have allowed a dog in the house either. Tied him up in the yard.
Right. Last one in bed for Harry Toad.
Sylvia gathers up some towels and takes them into an adjoining bathroom as her four boys jump up and down on their beds, lashing out at each other with their pillows. Barry watches indulgently from the doorway, with Porthos at his heels. In his imagination, the tall bedroom window drifts open, and in slow motion, the trampolining boys jump higher and higher until they become weightless and, as if on wires, fly out into the night sky. Later, Sylvia kisses the sleeping Michael on his cheek, tucks the eiderdown up around his shoulders, tiptoes out of the nursery bedroom, and softly closes the door. Barry is waiting on the landing. She turns to him with an exhausted sigh.
You mean a lot to my boys, you know.
They go into the sitting room.
Especially Peter.
He wanders over to a window.
It seems to me that Peter's trying to grow up too fast.
Sylvia sinks down in a chair.
I imagine he thinks that grown-ups don't hurt as deeply as children do when they lose someone.
Sylvia, who's been looking at Barry, turns away pensively.
I lost my older brother David when I was just Peter's age. And it nearly destroyed my mother.
James, I'm so sorry. Your poor mother. Can't imagine losing a child.
Aye.
He turns away from the window.
She didn't get out of bed for months. She wouldn't eat. I tried everything to make her happy, but...
He sits in a chair beside her.
She only wanted David. So, one day, I dressed myself in David's clothing. And I went to her.
You must have frightened her to death.
I think it was the first time she ever actually looked at me.
Sylvia looks at him with a concerned smile, then lowers her brown eyes.
And that was the end of the boy, James. I used to say to myself he'd gone to Neverland.
Where?
Neverland. It's a wonderful place.
His eyes shine, but becoming self-conscious under her sympathetic gaze, he looks away.
I've not spoken about this before to anyone. Ever.
Sensing a growing air of familiarity, neither of them can quite meet the other's eye. Barry smiles shyly.
What's it like? Neverland.
The moment passes.
One day I'll take you there.
On a London street behind a flock of nuns.
Wait a minute, James. He's a fairy?
No, he's the irrepressible spirit of youth. Tinkerbell is the fairy.
Tinkerbell is a woman.
She's not a woman, she's a fairy. He is a boy who stays young forever.
James, how does anyone stay young forever? It doesn't work.
He just believes, Charles. He imagines life the way he wants it to be, and he believes in it long enough and hard enough that it all appears before him, you see?
James, I'm your friend. You're coming off a flop. You have a man who is a fairy, right?
A boy.
Yes, a fairy. And this girl calls herself Tinker, and you have a pirate ship on stage surrounded by tons and tons of water. That's a lot of water.
It's a lot of water?
Yes, and that's a lot of money.
It is, but we can fake the water.
Oh, well, if we can fake the water, then I'm sure your play will be a hit. You know what I think I'll do? I think I'll imagine life the way I want it to be.
Long enough and hard enough.
Yes, and then the money for the play will appear magically before me. How's
that's
that?
Right. That's it.
Yes. How does the clock wind up inside the crocodile?
He swallows it.
Ah, of course he does.
At a cricket match. Sylvia and the boys applaud.
How was he?
Well done.
Barry in cricket gear sits with his friend Arthur.
Finally get the courage to invite the boys to a game and we have to suffer this grave humiliation. It's perfect, actually.
Spend a good deal of time with them, don't you?
Every moment I can spare, in fact.
I'm glad for you. And Mrs. Davis would be having a good time of it as well. Should be aware, though, James, what some people have been saying. Now, mind you, I wouldn't bring it up if I thought the rumours would pass.
Not surprised. What are they saying?
Very well. That you spend much more time with Mrs. Davis than you do with your own wife. She's a widow.
And a friend. That's it, nothing more.
There have also been questions about how you spend your time with those boys and why.
Barry turns and stares at his friend.
That's outrageous. How could anyone think something so evil? They're children, they're innocent children.
Arthur looks him squarely in the face.
You find a glimmer of happiness in this world. There's always someone who wants to destroy it. Oh. Thank you, Arthur, but I don't think many will give credence to such nonsense.
Then why is no one sitting with them?
Barry looks round at Sylvia and the boys.
Once you get a bit of notoriety, James, people watch you, and they will look for ways to drag you down.
Disapproving matronly looks come at them from all sides. Later, in Barry's car...
Are you sure your wife doesn't object to us taking over your cottage for the summer, James?
She doesn't go there anymore.
Really? It's such a relief to get away. You'll come and visit, I hope.
Of course. Are we in?
Everyone in?
Can I drive Uncle Jim?
No.
With Barry at the wheel, Sylvia next to him, and the boys in the back, they set off. Later, driving with the hood down along a muddy track in a grassy meadow, Barry, wearing a camel hair driving coat, has to stop to shoo a flock of sheep off the road. They jolt down the narrow unpaved road past a shepherdess and her flock. The boys almost bounce out of their seats as they drive over potholes, and Sylvia hangs on to her pale-coloured hat, all the while chatting happily to Barry. At the end of an avenue of horse chestnut trees, a rambling, thatched cottage comes into view. The children pile out of the car and into the house. Outside the leaded windows, tall spikes of hollyhocks grow in the garden. Inside, the furniture is covered in dust sheets.
Should we explore, Michael?
You're going outside. Don't tear your clothes, please.
Come on, follow me!
The boys rush out with Portos. Barry pulls a dustcloth off a chair. He and Sylvia exchange a shy smile.
Would you like to see the rest of it?
Yes.
He leads her through the house. Later, in the woodland grounds of the cottage, Barry, dressed as a pirate, in a cloak and headscarf, and wearing an eye patch, slinks through the trees, with Portos at his side. Brandishing a wooden sword, he creeps up behind 5-year-old Michael, who's crouching by a tree and peering about nervously.
Hello!
Thought you could escape from Captain Swally, eh? Off to the ship with you, then.
Off to the ship, son!
The scene mixes to a fantastical pirate ship and back again.
You can either choose to become a pirate with the rest of us, or we'll toss you to the sharks.
How marvellous!
Or maybe the crocodiles, eh?
Pirate Sylvia.
No one's escaped, Captain!
Excellent work, matey. Now then, now is your only chance to speak. Who amongst you is ready to tie your hopes and dreams to the sea?
I am!
Not finished yet.
To enter upon the most dangerous chapter in your young and soon-to-be-wasted lives.
What did you say? What are you doing, son? Are you giggling on my ship? Giggling?
What did you say?
I said I'm ready, Captain.
What's your name, boy?
I'm Curly, the oldest and whitest of the crew.
Cut him loose, matey. Welcome aboard, Curly. Your job will be to mop the deck.
He threatens Jack with his hook.
And who be you, young squire?
My name be Nipsa Cutthroat. Feared by man and greatly desired by the ladies.
Jack!
Welcome aboard, Nibs. You shall polish onward surfaces.
Grab a hold of that rigging.
And you, lad?
I'm Peter.
That's not a pirate name. What about Dastardly Jim, eh?
No. Just Peter. I like my name.
On the ship.
Very well. In punishment for lack of an interesting pirate name, Peter shall walk the plank. Cut him loose.
Sylvia cuts Peter free from the mast, and he's forced to walk the plank. As he jumps, the cannons fire and the scene changes to the stage of Charles Frohman's theatre. A stage manager hands out scripts to the assembled actors. Sitting in the stalls, Frohman checks his watch. An actor and actress leave through their parts, looking puzzled. Other actors do the same.
The boy.
What have you got, excuse me?
Mr. Barry, sir.
A burly actor comes up to Barry.
There's been a mistake here, sir. It says here I'm to play the nanny.
Don't imagine I quite fit that part, eh?
You're not actually the nanny. You're a dog.
What?
A Newfoundland. Hope you're in a great big fluffy dog suit.
Arr. The stage manager growls at the flummoxed actor.
Oh, right.
Actually, we don't have a Tinkerbell cast, do we? You could play Tinkerbell.
It's not. Tinkerbell's a light that moves around the stage. Just a wee light that moves around the stage.
Now the stage manager looks puzzled. He turns to the cast.
A bit worried about this.
Let's see. We've got John Darling, Michael Darling, Tiger Lily, Smee, Skylines. It's a play for puppets. Toodles, Nibs, Curly. All of these names are absurd when you see them all together. Captain Hook, Sergeant. Oh, hello, James.
Frohman has retreated to the theatre bar.
You're out of your mind.
James waves at him sheepishly through the glass door of the bar. That evening at home, Mary is cutting and pasting clippings into a scrapbook. She glances up as her husband appears in the doorway of the drawing room.
How were rehearsals?
Fine.
great. They're going quite well.
Good.
Yes, thank you.
She gives him a pinched smile. He hesitates, then steps up to the settee where she's sitting, leans over and plants a kiss on her cheek. She accepts the gesture without returning the kiss, but her breathing quickens. As he straightens up, he gently brushes her cheek with his hand. With a look of hurt resentment, she watches him leave the room. On the overgrown lawn in front of the country cottage, Sylvia is hanging out washing on a line. Barry drives up in his car. He bolts down from the car.
Hello.
Hello.
How was your journey?
It's quite long. I'm exhausted.
Let's get you some tea.
That'd be nice, thanks.
Michael runs out from the trees.
Can you come to the playhouse?
In a moment, Michael. He's just arrived.
But I said I'd get him. They always send Peter to do things. I said I'll do it. It will spoil the surprise.
What surprise, darling?
It's a great surprise. We've taken most of the day preparing for it. Everybody's waiting for you.
Then we mustn't keep them waiting.
Please don't tell them that I told you the surprise. I said I wouldn't.
Oh, well, you didn't really tell us anything about it, did you?
Yes, I did. It's a play.
It's a play.
Sylvia and Barry sit in front of a makeshift stage. George, dressed as some sort of monster, pulls back the curtains to reveal Michael, dressed as a lady, and Peter clutching his leather-bound writing book.
The Lamentable Tale of Lady Ursula, a play in one act by Peter Lewin and Davies. This is just a bit of silliness, really.
I should hope so. Go on.
I just wanted to take a stab at writing, you know. Well, the others do a good job with it anyway.
Well, let's see it then.
As Peter reads, the others mime.
The Lamentable Tale of Lady Ursula. One morning, just after sunrise, Lady Ursula, the most beautiful daughter of Lord and Lady Dubon, made her way up the steps of the great cathedral to pray to her blessed saint. Suddenly, as she reached the cathedral doors, the gargoyle that guarded the sacred structure came to life and swooped down upon her.
Barry glances at Sylvia with concern.
The people of the village all ran for safety, but Lady Ursula slipped on the cathedral steps and the gargoyle descended upon her, wrapping her in its huge wings and taking her high up into the spires of the cathedral.
Go on, Peter.
Not long after this sorrowful event, a young knight named J.M. Barnaby came into the city.
Sylvia, come here. Do you want some water?
The boys gather around their mother.
No, James.
Back in the house. Go on.
Later, Barry leads a doctor up the narrow cottage staircase.
She won't discuss her with me at all. She claims it was nothing. I tell your doctor, she couldn't breathe.
You can't very well treat a patient who won't admit there's anything wrong.
You'll have to make her understand that something is.
I'll try and do my best.
Okay, just here.
Barry goes downstairs. In the cluttered main room of the cottage, Barry sits in a wing-back chair, legs casually crossed, reading. Peter sits with a book on his knee, in an almost identical pose. George, Jack and Michael busy themselves with crayons and paper. Barry moistens a stamp, places it sticky side up on a penny coin, and flips it at the ceiling. The coin falls away, leaving the stamp stuck to the ceiling. Immediately, all four boys join in.
Get around flat like that.
One coin clips Barry.
Like that.
As the boys play on, Barry sits pensively in his chair. The doctor comes out of the bedroom. Barry meets him at the top of the stairs. As the doctor comes down, George, Jack and Michael pretend not to have been trying to overhear. Peter just stares at the foot of the stairway.
Come in.
With an apprehensive, almost shy smile, Barry steps into the low, oak-beamed upstairs bedroom and crosses to the window, hands behind his back.
Good doctor didn't fill up to the challenge on this one. I think she need to go to hospital for further tests.
Nonsense. When would I have time for that? Besides, this family's had enough of hospitals.
Perhaps they can help you.
I know what they can do for me. Saw what they did for my husband. No, James. No interest in hospitals. though I'm keenly interested in having some supper.
Out in the garden, Peter is smashing all the props from the play. Barry, coming downstairs, hears the noise and peers out of a window. Peter is tearing down the curtains and overturning the furniture. Barry comes out and sits on one of the chairs facing the stage. He watches Peter with a grave expression.
What did you and Mother decide to tell us this time? It's only a chest cold.
We hadn't decided anything.
Stop lying to me! I'm sick of grown-ups lying to me!
I'm not lying to you. I don't know what's wrong.
Father might take us fishing. That's what she said. In just a few weeks. And he died the next morning.
That wasn't a lie, Peter. That was your mother's hope.
He'd barely moved for a week, but I started planning our fishing trip.
I will never lie to you. I promise you that.
No. All you'll do is teach me to make up stupid stories and pretend that things aren't happening until...
Peter snatches up the leather writing book and tears out the pages he's written.
I won't! I'm not blind! I won't be made a fool!
Sylvia hurries up.
What's this? Peter? The play. Darling, I wanted to see the rest of it.
She hugs her son as Barry sits brooding.
Magic's gone out of it a bit now, hasn't it? All because of a silly chest cold.
Peter wrenches himself from his mother's arms and hurries away. Sylvia and Barry watch him go, and their eyes meet. As the evening light fades, Barry pulls away from the cottage with the family. Indoors, his stamp flutters down from the ceiling. At his London house, Portos waits faithfully by the front door. Barry looks down the hall towards the drawing room and sees the back view of his wife, in evening dress, in earnest conversation, with an elegant man wearing black tie. They stand up hurriedly as Barry appears in the doorway.
James. Well, you remember Gilbert Cannon, don't you?
Good evening.
Mr. Cannon has been working on the committee to fight government censorship.
Mary hands him a leaflet.
I know how involved you've been as well.
He wanted to speak to you. Did think you'd be home so much sooner.
It's been a long evening, Mary.
Yes. Well, if I'd realised how late it was, of course.
I should perhaps talk to you at another time. Not so late.
That would be fine.
Gilbert Cannon gathers his things from the table.
We'll talk then. Thank you for your patience, Mrs. Barry. Mr. Barry. Good night.
Barry turns to watch the debonair visitor leave. Mary, in her black and gold evening gown, wears a mixed expression of apprehension and willfulness. Barry, still in his flapping driving coat, turns back into the room and stands, hands behind his back, his eyes drifting uncomfortably.
Well, aren't you going to speak?
What would you like me to see? Curious how late Mr. Cannon stayed, I suppose. And then let's see what comes next.
His dark eyes are mocking and resentful.
No later than you were out, James. And how is Mrs. Davies this evening? Oh, yes, I would have a great answer for that one, wouldn't I?
How dare you?
Mary tilts her chin defiantly.
This isn't one of your plays.
I know that, Mary. It's quite serious.
He starts to go.
But I'm not ready for this conversation, wherever it may lead. Perhaps we can talk in the morning, yes? Good night, then.
Mary stares after him, her eyes burning with frustration and suppressed anger. She turns away and switches off a lamp. As she starts to leave the room, Mary sees Barry's leather-bound journal on the occasional table by the door. She hesitates, then picks it up, and turning it over in her hands, clasps it firmly. She switches off the remaining lamp and leaves the room. In the morning, sunlight floods in through the windows of Barry's bedroom. He lies under the bedclothes, half asleep. A figure lies in the bed beside him. Barry stirs and tugs irritably at the cover, pulling it more to his side of the bed. Portos lifts his furry head from the pillow, grabs the cover in his teeth, and pulls it back to his side. Later, Barry comes out of his room dressed in a grey suit. He pauses outside Mary's sitting room, as if about to knock. Then he turns on his heel and goes downstairs. In her pale grey sitting room, Mary sits with her back to the window, in a dark skirt, pale blouse and long grey cardigan. She opens her husband's journal and starts to read. In the theatre wardrobe, an actor is being fitted into his costume.
Mr. Barry, don't you agree this is a little bit tight?
No. No, in fact, I think it's quite... baggy.
Baggy?
Quite frumpy. I'd bring it right in, just there.
That's very tight.
Mm, right there. You can put maybe a plank of wood there to straighten him up.
Oh, yeah. Yes, Mr. Barry.
Plank of wood?
Some wood there in the shoulders. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's marvellous.
Right.
The actor smiles uncertainly. In her sitting room, Mary looks up uneasily from the journal. At the Davis house, 5-year-old Michael answers the door. In the garden...
You'll be sick tomorrow.
I'll be sick tonight.
The boys look up from their tea.
Davis.
Sylvia recovers her composure.
Just having some tea. You remember my mother, of course?
Yes, of course. How do you do?
Barry's wearing a red Indian headdress with war paint on his face.
May I take your hat? That's enough, boys.
Later, as Barry is leaving.
Boys, please don't run in the house. You'll break something. Come away from that door. Come on, come on, come on, come on.
I'd like a word with you, Mr. Barry, before you go. We'll only be a few minutes. Boys, why don't you go and play in the garden? Go on.
Is he in trouble? Shh. Because I've been alone with Grandmother, and I know what it's like.
Shall we retire into the study? Why don't you join them, dear?
Sylvia withdraws. James, still wearing war paint, follows Mrs. de Maurier into the study.
I do apologise for interrupting.
Would you close the door, please?
Certainly.
Sylvia has told me you've offered her the services of your household staff.
Well, not exactly.
That won't be necessary.
I'll leave that to Sylvia, of course.
You'll leave that to me, Mr. Barry. You see, I'm moving in here from now on.
You're moving in?
I'm going where I'm most needed. And I can certainly see to it that this house is managed without resorting to your charity.
It isn't charity, Mrs. de Maurier. I was only trying to help as a friend.
Have you no idea how much your friendship has already cost my daughter? Or are you really that selfish?
I beg your pardon?
Don't you see what a visit to the summer cottage of a married man does for a widow's future prospects?
She avoids his eyes.
Sylvia needs to find someone. The boys need a father.
Barry looks down, wounded.
And you are destroying any hope this family has of pulling itself together again.
I have only wanted good things for this family, Mrs. de Maurier.
Oh, look after them. You have your own family to concern yourself with.
What are you suggesting?
I'm suggesting that you protect what you have, Mr. Barry. That is precisely what I am doing.
Later, Barry comes to the wrought iron railings in front of his house. He opens the gate and goes inside. As he comes into his own sitting room, he finds Mary waiting for him with his leather journal in her hands.
I was so certain what I would find in this. Some little confession would leak out onto the page.
I don't write love notes in my journal.
No. Still, you knew who I meant, didn't you? That's some comfort, actually. It means I know you just a little after all.
But you needn't steal my journal to get to know me, Mary.
No. I suppose I could just go see the plays.
She goes to the window. He sits at his desk.
I was hopelessly naive when I married you. I imagined that brilliant people disappeared to some secret place where good ideas floated around like leaves in autumn. And I hoped at least once you would take me there with you.
There is no such place.
She places the journal on the desk in front of him.
Yes, there is. Neverland.
She sits facing him.
It's the best you've written, James. And I'm sure the Davies will adore the world you've created for them. I only wish I were part of it.
I've wanted you to be.
I've tried.
He reads the reproach in her eyes, shakes his head, and gets up.
Mary, I always imagined us going off on great adventures once we were together. But we moved into this house and you started, I don't know, you started rearranging the furniture.
What were you supposed to do, James? You were always gone.
I was right here.
Sitting in your parlour, staring off into other worlds as though I didn't exist.
He moves back behind his desk.
Look, just give me a bit more time to finish up the play.
Spend with your muse. No, I'm tired of waiting, James. I'm tired of looking like a fool.
She pauses at the door.
Well, I can't very well give up the play.
Of course not. Just come home to me at the end of the day. Rehearse and be home for dinner. No more trips to the country, no more long afternoons in the park. If you can't give us that much of a chance, then we must end this.
She reaches firmly for the door handle.
And I will.
An actor in a dog costume waddles across the stage on all fours.
Pitiful display.
The actors dressed as Captain Hook and Smee watch from the wings.
Nanny! Nanny!
The sweaty actor takes off his dog's head and peers out at Barry sitting in the stalls.
First you get the pyjamas, then you make the bed.
With my paws?
You make the beds with your paws, the pyjamas you get with your teeth. Because in fact, being a dog, you haven't any proper digits, have you?
Well, I don't have any teeth either. I mean, I can't see, I can't breathe. All I've got is this rubbery snout.
Barry turns to his glum-looking producer.
Can we get him some teeth?
He can have mine.
We'll get your teeth. Let's have a wee break, shall we?
Aye.
The dog-suited actor shuffles off to his companions in the wings.
I thought you were wonderful.
You were marvellous.
I think you're better on four legs than you are on two.
Absolutely.
Oh, give it
a do. Come on.
Just say it, Charles, go on.
Well, you picture it, James. Opening night. Doctors, lawyers, businessmen and their wives, all dressed to the nines. They pay good money. They're expecting theater, what we call theater. The curtain opens and it's crocodiles and fairies and pirates and Indians. I don't even know what it is.
Barry raises a finger.
But you did know, Charles. You're an absolute genius, Charles. That's it.
Oh, don't patronize me, James. You know how much money I put into this show that I haven't even found yet?
Listen. Opening night. I want 25 seats set aside.
Set aside?
25 seats. Right. Scattered throughout the theatre. Two here, two yeah. there, three up there.
Are they paid for? But
they're filled.
No,
the
no,
seats
no.
are filled, so don't you worry.
Uncle Jim.
Hello, boys.
Can I speak to you for a moment, please?
Certainly. Like 25 seats, Charles.
Yeah, James.
It'd be great. It's going to be fantastic.
25 scattered seats. Who's paying for them?
Throughout the theatre.
Yeah, who's paying for these 25
worry,
scattered?
They're filled up seats, Charles.
Jack is trying the flying harness.
This is great. I'm flying.
We don't need to use much pull at all, see, as long as we got the balance down.
Mother asked me to take the boys out for the afternoon. She said she only wanted a bit of quiet. But she was trembling so badly she couldn't even finish her tea. I'm not a fool, Uncle James. I deserve to know the truth.
I don't know the truth. She won't talk about it.
But you think it's serious?
It could be. The doctor felt she should go and have some tests.
Then you'll have to convince her to go, then.
I've tried. She won't listen to me. And lately, to be quite honest, it seems that all my best intentions for your family have come to nothing but harm. Apparently, I've made quite a mess of things.
It's grandmother, isn't it? She's run you off, hasn't she?
Oh, she's absolutely tried with great effort and perhaps with good reason.
It isn't you, Uncle Jim. She just doesn't want to see Mother hurt anymore.
George looks towards the stage where Jack and Michael are having a go on the flying harness. Barry watches him.
Look at that.
George looks uncomprehending.
How magnificent. The boy's gone. Somewhere during the last 30 seconds, you've become a grown up. Right then. I think you should be the one to talk to her, George.
But I won't know what to say.
You'll do fine. You'll do just fine.
Smee.
Mr. Barry, sir. Sorry to interrupt. It's Nana. He's expired backstage.
What's happened?
I think his costume is too tight.
It's not possible to... George, give me a minute. I'll be back.
On stage, the stage manager straps George into the flying harness as Jack and Michael watch.
Put that one tight.
There you go, last one. Good. Okay, flap those wings.
George flies up.
Whoa!
Jack steps forward.
Can I have a go?
Yeah, you can have a little go, go on. Give that a tug.
Jack takes one of the ropes.
Can I have a go?
In a minute.
Jack,
in a minute.
Can I have a go?
I have to concentrate.
Stop it now, boys.
No, Michael.
Talking about, boys. Come
I
on.
Know.
The stage manager trips, letting go of the rope. George plummets to the stage, landing on his arm. Stage crew and Barry rush to help.
Hold on, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
George?
Barry, Mrs. Du Maurier, Jack, Peter and Michael wait on a marble-floored hospital landing.
Mr. Barry, Mrs. Davis would like a word.
Mrs. Du Maurier stands up.
No, just Mr. Barry.
Mrs. Du Maurier flashes Barry a hostile look as the white-coated doctor leads him away to a room where Sylvia is waiting with a peeved look on her face. George, in a side room with a nurse, looks knowingly at Barry through the open connecting door.
Did you encourage this?
Encourage what?
James, please. You know perfectly well what. George won't allow them to set his arm unless I submit to an examination.
Barry nods in surprise.
I see. Well, I suppose you'll have to then, because he's quite a stubborn young man when he sets his mind to it.
This is absurd. They won't tell me anything different.
Different? So you've already spoken to a doctor then?
That is not your concern.
Sylvia, wearing her customary white, shuts the door to the room where George is waiting to be treated.
My wish is that life should go on as normal. So, I'll have the examination. And I'll take whatever medications they advise. But I don't want to know what they're for. And I don't want you inquiring into it any further.
Barry nods gravely. It's evening as Barry, in his camel hair coat and hat, leaves the hospital and strides off down the empty street, back towards his home. In the house, there are no lights in the hall as he hurries upstairs.
Mary? Mary?
There is no one there. A carved wardrobe stands with its doors open, empty. Barry peers inside, then switches off the one table lamp and leaves the room. At her home, Sylvia is getting the boys dressed in their smartest clothes. George has his arm in a sling.
Peter, could you help George to fold a pocket handkerchief, please? They're in the linen cupboard. Darling?
Yes, Mother.
Jack, how do you manage to always come untucked? Would you check your shirt tails in the intermission, please?
Yes, Mother.
You're not planning on attending any after-theatre events, are you?
Only for a short time if we do. The tickets!
With the children?
George! Possibly. Would you see if George has the tickets, please?
All right.
I'll just check the dressing table.
Sylvia, those
no,
events
Mother,
are
Mother, please see if George has the tickets. Michael, where are your socks? Wait here, don't move.
She goes into her bedroom. As she searches the drawers of her writing desk, she collapses. Outside the Duke of York's theatre, a poster announces the opening night of Peter Pan. Patrons in evening dress file into the foyer and find their seats in the auditorium. While James Barry hovers in the vestibule between the stage and the stalls, peeping through the curtains at the audience, Mrs. Du Maurier helps her daughter into bed.
Take her feet, George.
The boys help tuck their mother in.
We'll need some more blankets.
George and Jack go.
Take Michael with you, would you?
George puts his hand on Michael's shoulder and ushers him out.
Much worse than when we were at the cottage.
At the theatre, Charles Frohman talks to his front-of-house manager.
25 seats. Is anyone showing up?
No, sir, not yet.
Precisely. Have there been many people asking for seats?
Yes, sir.
Charles, I suggest you start selling.
Charles.
Yes, James.
Have you seen any of the Davies family yet this evening?
The 25 seats, are they filled?
It's taken care of?
Yes, yes.
Who did you invite? Because obviously whoever you invited decided not to come.
The seats will be filled, I promise.
Don't worry. You've been promising me.
Charles?
Hello, Mr. Stanley.
Have you seen the Davies family this evening?
No, sir.
Jack has gone to get Dr. Brighton.
Oh, no, Mother, I don't need a doctor.
Yes, you do, yes.
Peter looks on anxiously.
I think I'll get some chamomile to help you relax. Peter will be here if you need anything.
Peter perches on the edge of his mother's bed.
Peter.
She strokes his cheek with her fingers and leans back against the pillows, eyes shut. Peter watches her adoringly, his hair slicked down in a neat parting, his jacket buttoned tight.
Can I do anything, Mother?
No, darling. You must go to the play.
He looks at her gravely.
I can't do that.
Yes, you can. I need you to. I need you to come back tonight and tell me every bit of it. Please.
It's only a play, Mother.
She smiles as her eyes film with tears and she reaches into the drawer of her bedside table.
What do you want?
Take it out.
He lifts out the leather-bound writing book Barry had given him.
Open it.
The pages of Peter's play script that he tore out have been carefully pasted back in their place. He looks at them, then up at his mother, who gazes at him earnestly.
I've never been so proud of you.
He smiles with real pleasure. She reaches out and with her eyes welling with tears, she pulls him into her arms. Pressing her lips to the top of his young head, she tries to hold back her tears. At the theatre.
Last call, please, ladies and gentlemen. Last call for the...
Yes. We are trying to sell those 25 seats.
Barry, wearing white tie and tails, unflinchingly stays standing on the theatre steps, peering down the street. Around the corner, a crocodile of children appears. He calls back inside.
Charles.
What?
They're here.
Who's here?
Charles Frohman comes out of the foyer and sees the smocked and pinafored children.
We'll forgive them being a bit late. Short legs, long walk from the orphanage.
I'm not clear what they're doing here.
We've come to see the play.
Mm-hmm.
That's the 25 seats.
Mm. 25 seats given to orphans. Right. Now my nightmare is complete.
You can start your play now.
Your play.
As the children file in, a carriage pulls up in the dark street outside the theatre. Barry steps down onto the road. Peter gets out, clutching his leather-bound writing book. In the theatre, under a painted front cloth of a pirate ship and fairies, the orchestra strikes up the overture. Ushers scurry through the auditorium with the orphan children and guide them to seats scattered throughout the stall's audience. The impeccably turned-out playgoers react with surprise and even distaste as the children, scrubbed and shining, but meanly dressed, plop themselves down in their allotted places. A chubby-faced boy stares around in wonder as he takes his seat. More children troop down the steeply raked steps of the dress circle. A fashionably dressed couple stare at each other as they stand to let a young latecomer in a blue suit come past them. It's Peter.
Looks like we got one of the better dressed ones.
In the wings.
I just want you to know, I think you're a wonderful dog.
Thanks.
The actor playing Nana gives Smee a grateful pat on the arm and dons his fluffy grey and white dog's head. The lighting board cranks into action. Peter gazes at the stage, wide-eyed. The curtain rises on a nursery bedroom with three small beds, a window at the back and a large blue kennel set beside it. Nana, the Newfoundland dog, enters on all fours and looks at the audience, who stare back, mystified. One of the orphan boys stands up for a better view, grinning with delight. Still on all fours, Nana lollops over to a chest of drawers, picks up some pyjamas in her mouth and places them onto one of the beds. The mouth of the dog costume has been fitted with a small hook, and Nana deftly uses it to pull back the blue and white checked cover on the bed. An actress dressed as a boy runs on. She wears a sailor suit and carries a teddy bear.
I won't go to bed. I won't. I won't. Nana, it isn't 6 o'clock yet. 2 minutes more. Please. 1 minute more. Nana, I will not be bathed. I tell you, I will not be bathed.
As the boy girl runs into the bathroom, the adults begin to catch on.
Who are you?
As the scene unfolds, Charles Frohman sidles into the back of the stalls to watch. On stage, Mrs. Darling turns back from the window.
No one there. Yet I feel sure I saw a face.
She hurries to the bathroom.
My children.
George opens the front door of the Davis house.
How is she?
She's resting.
I see her.
No, Mr. Barry, I don't think we need to include you on everything that goes on in this household.
But she'd want to see you.
Be quiet, George. And since, as I've discovered, you've seen fit to conceal certain facts about my daughter's condition from me, I feel no remorse at excluding you from my home.
But you can't simply...
Go upstairs, George,
stop
now!
Stop ordering me about! This isn't your home, it's our home. Jessica's mother's needed your help recently. It doesn't give you the right to rule over her existence. She's not a child anymore. Neither am I. If she wants to see Uncle Jim, she can see Uncle Jim. There's nothing you can do about it.
Leaving Mrs. DeMurray nonplussed, George takes Barry upstairs.
Mother?
Yes, darling?
Barry, in his white tie and tail, steps into the room.
James.
She fusses with the bedclothes.
No. Your play.
She gathers up some clothing off the bed.
Look at all this.
And starts to get up.
I'd have come tonight. It's just... Mother, I still have things to do here. See, this needs mending. Four boys. No end of patches. Can't seem to keep up.
Barry watches her gravely.
I haven't the time for all this. Don't look at me like that, James. You make me feel so utterly exposed.
She goes to the writing desk and sits down with her back to him.
Boys, could you give me a moment with your mother, please? Thank you.
Michael and George leave, and Barry closes the door after them. Sylvia raises her eyes anxiously but does not look round. She has a silky grey shawl over her nightdress and her fair hair loosely pinned up. Barry turns back into the room and broodily gazes at the back of her head.
You can see it, you know. You can't go on just pretending.
Just pretending?
Ruefully, she turns to look at him.
You brought pretending into this family, James. You showed us we can change things by simply believing them to be different.
A lot of things, Sylvia, not everything.
But the things that matter. We've pretended for some time now that you're a part of this family, haven't we?
She looks up at him and then away, her cheeks wet with tears.
You've come to mean so much to us all that now it doesn't matter if it's true. And even if it isn't true, even if that can never be, I need to go on pretending. Until the end. With you.
On stage, an actress is playing Peter Pan.
Oh, I am sweet.
How do you do it?
You just think lovely, wonderful thoughts and they lift you up in the air.
Peter Pan flies up onto the mantelpiece.
You are so nippy at it. Couldn't you do it very slowly, once?
The harness operator pulls on the ropes and Peter floats slowly back to the floor.
Yes, I've got it now, Wendy.
Bespectacled John tries and falls.
I must blow fairy dust on you first.
The actress playing Peter Pan blows fairy dust on the actress playing Michael, then Wendy, and lastly, on John.
Now try. Try from the bed. Just wriggle your shoulders like this and then let go. I flew!
How ripping!
Lovely! Now join hands.
All three children and Peter Pan rise into the air.
Look at me!
I do like it!
Look at me!
Look at me! Look at me! Let's go out!
The stage windows open. At the back of the stalls, producer Charles Frohman shakes his head in admiration. At home, Sylvia has moved onto a chaise longue.
I want you to go back to the theatre. Find Peter.
Of course.
Thank you.
Barry is perched on the edge of the chaise, holding her hand.
You sure there's nothing else I can do for you?
She rests her head back on a pillow.
No. Well, I have always wanted to go to Neverland. You did promise to tell me about it, you know.
Aye, that I did.
It's a bit late for it tonight, though, I'm afraid.
Wearily, she closes her eyes.
Perhaps sometime soon, though.
He gently pats her hand.
Most definitely.
Do you mean we shall both be drowned?
Look how the water is rising.
On stage above the actors' heads, a string decorated with ribbons.
It must be the tail of the kite we made for Michael. You remember? It tore itself out of his hands and floated away.
Peter Pan's eyes light up.
The kite? Why shouldn't it carry you? Both of us? It can't lift two. Michael and Curly tried.
I won't go without you, Peter. Let us draw lots which is to stay behind.
And you, a lady? Never.
Peter makes Wendy hold onto the kite tail.
Ready, Wendy?
Peter!
As Wendy circles the ornate auditorium, Peter Pan is left alone on the rock.
To die will be an awfully big adventure.
Barry hurries back to the theatre. He makes his way down some steps to his usual hiding place for spying on audience and actors, but he's been beaten to it. His wife, Mary, peeping through the curtains, looks round at him diffidently.
I'm glad you came.
Well, I never missed an opening. So I assume you've heard about Gilbert and I.
Yes.
He smiles warmly.
Quite the scandal, so I'm told.
He's standing a few steps above her. A genuinely kind smile hovers on his lips as he looks into her face.
How are you?
She climbs the steps to be on a level with him.
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm sorry.
Don't be. Without that family, you could never have written anything like this. You need them.
She kisses him on the cheek and whispers into his ear.
Goodbye.
The delighted audience stream out of the theatre. Barry prowls around the opening night party.
Mr. Barry.
Mrs. Snow.
Thank you. That was quite the nicest evening I've ever spent in the theatre.
That's very kind of you to say. Thank you. Was Mr. Snow this evening?
Oh, I'm afraid he's left us. And he would so have loved this evening. The pirates and the Indians. He was really just a boy himself, you know. To the very end.
Terribly sorry. How are you doing?
I'm doing well enough now, thank you. I suppose it's all the work of the ticking crocodile, isn't it? Time is chasing after all of us. Isn't that right?
Barry nods warmly.
That's right, Mrs. Snow.
Aunt Rose, your drink.
Thank you. I mustn't keep you. You have a lot of friends here.
Well, it's lovely to see you. I'm terribly sorry once again.
Is that Mr. Barry?
That was Mr. Barry.
Well done, Mr. Barry.
Well done. Well done. Well done. Well done.
Barry finds Peter in the crush and comes up behind him.
Psst.
Peter turns round, smiling.
What do you think?
It's about our summer together, isn't it?
It is.
About all of us.
That's right.
Barry looks at him inquiringly.
Do you like it?
Peter grins.
It's magical. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Peter.
This is Peter Pan. How wonderful.
Really? You're Peter Pan? Why, you must be quite the little adventurer.
Look, it's true, he has no shadow.
But I'm not Peter Pan. He is.
Barry and Peter share a look of complicit understanding. Sometime later, Sylvia, in bed in her room, is being attended by a doctor.
There's been no improvement in that since my last visit.
He closes his fob watch.
No.
The doctor scribbles in his notebook. Behind him, Mrs. Dumouriez is busying herself folding some clothes.
Joan's been by it all today, Mother.
Mrs. Dumouriez shakes her head.
Dr. Brighton, may I have a word?
The doctor looks at George in surprise.
Excuse me.
He leaves the room. Sylvia looks coolly across at her mother.
You haven't been keeping him from me, have you?
As a matter of fact, I actually hoped he might come. It would have proved me wrong about him. Of course, with the success of his play, the whole of London must be knocking at his door.
Mrs. Du Maurier sits on Sylvia's bed, her expression a mixture of compassion and condescension.
Sorry, dear.
The four boys come in grinning conspiratorially, followed by the doctor.
What is it?
It's a secret.
Quiet, Michael.
I didn't say anything.
Mother, could you come downstairs for a moment?
Of course she can't come downstairs. What are you thinking of, George?
Actually, I think a trip downstairs might do her good, ma'am.
Mrs. Du Maurier and the children help Sylvia down the stairs. Peter leads them down into the spacious drawing room, where a bewhiskered musician sits at the piano, alongside a handful of string players in white tie and tails.
It's a play.
It's not just a play, Michael. It's the play.
Sylvia, despite her weakness, smiles.
Of course, we'll have to make do with a few compromises. Much of it will have to be imagined.
As it should be.
As it should be, that's right.
Barry leads her to a settee and two chairs placed against the wall. He and the boys sit on either side of her. With a dubious glance, Mrs. Du Maurier takes her seat. Barry nods to the pianist.
You're ready.
Sylvia looks intently at Barry, who clasps her hand in his. Arranged opposite the settee are the three nursery beds from the stage set. From the hallway, Nana scrambles in on all fours and squeezes past the real Newfoundland. Portos barks at Nana, who barks back. The young actress in the sailor suit scampers in.
I won't go to bed. I won't. Nana, it isn't 6 o'clock yet. 2 minutes more. Please.
You know fairies, Peter?
Yes. But they're nearly all dead now. You see, Wendy, when the first baby laughed for the first time, the laugh broke into 1,000 pieces and they all went skipping about. And that was the beginning of fairies. And now when every new baby is born, its first laugh becomes a fairy. So there ought to be one fairy for every boy and girl.
Ought to be, isn't there?
Oh, no. Children know such a lot now. Soon they don't believe in fairies. And every time a child says, I don't believe in fairies, there's a fairy somewhere that falls down dead.
Later, a light bouncing off a mirror flutters over Peter Pan's face.
Who is that?
The actress next to the props man holding the mirror tinkles a bell.
The Redskins were defeated. Wendy and the boys captured by the pirates. I'll rescue her.
Peter Pan answers the invisible fairy.
Oh, that's just my medicine. Poisoned? Who could have poisoned it? Why, Tink, you've drunk my medicine.
The Tinkerbell light hovers unsteadily.
It was poisoned. And you drank it to save my life.
Tinkerbell flutters towards a floor lamp, which lights up.
Tink, are you dying?
The light from the floor lamp fades and brightens, gradually becoming weaker.
Her light is growing faint. If it goes out, that means she's dead.
Sylvia's eyes brim with tears.
Her voice is so low I can scarcely hear what she's saying. She says she thinks she could get well again if children believed in fairies.
Slowly, Peter Pan turns to face the small audience of Mrs. Du Maurier, the boys, Sylvia and Barry.
Do you believe in fairies?
Mrs. Du Maurier nods faintly.
Say quick that you believe.
The boys are dumbstruck. Jack glances up at his grandmother.
If you believe, clap your hands. Clap louder!
Mrs. Du Maurier is the first to applaud. Behind Peter Pan, the drawing room drapes rise like a state curtain.
Thank you. Thank you.
Peter Pan bows. Behind him, the back wall of the house has vanished, and the walled garden has changed into a misty, green, magical country of fairies and other strange creatures. Barry takes Sylvia by the hand and leads her to the edge of the enchanted land. Mrs. Du Maurier, overcome with emotion, stays seated, urging George to follow his mother and brothers. Peter Pan rises into the air and flies down into the garden, landing next to a strutting peacock fairy and a fat crocodile. Mermaids recline by a small circular pond, and a fairy flies by on a swing. Barry brings Mrs. DeMori over to join the rest of the family. As Sylvia watches, spellbound, Barry whispers to her,
"That is never allowed."
Watched by a goblin with dragonfly wings, Indian braves glide through the lush vegetation. Their leader, Tiger Lily, leaps into view, her eyes wary. And sure enough, through the mists, Captain Hook and two of his pirate crew creep through the undergrowth. Peter Pan climbs onto a rock to watch, and more fairies fly down. Peter Pan smiles with satisfaction as the pirates slither away. With a look back at Barry, Sylvia, her head held high, slowly walks down the stone steps into the magical garden, her long blonde hair falling loose about her shoulders, her cream nightgown now changed into the dress of a medieval princess, with wide sleeves edged in brown and gold. Two fairies step up behind her and pick up the train of her dress. As she glides down the garden path and onto the grass, the garden slowly darkens. And she fades from sight. The darkness clears to reveal the damp lawns and funereal masonry of a London cemetery. Mrs. DeMaurier, Barry, and the four boys stand at the side of an open grave as the mourners slowly disperse. Peter clutching his leather-bound writing book to his chest.
So many perfect days. I really began to believe we'd go on like that forever.
Peter looks up at Barry.
Oh, stop it. She wasn't going to stay with you forever. She had a husband. My father. She never cared for you the way she did for him.
Barry gapes.
I'm not trying to replace your father, Peter. I could never do that.
With a harsh look that's almost a sneer, Peter climbs the steps to the cloister-like courtyard that leads to the cemetery gates. Barry goes to follow him.
You'd best let him go.
Mrs. DeMaurier turns to the other boys.
George, would you take the boys back to the house? I'll be with you in a moment.
George, Jack and Michael disappear down the colonnade after Peter. Mrs. DeMaurier stops, level with Barry, and looks up at him.
I'm terribly sorry. I've ruined everything I've touched in this family.
Stop giving yourself so much credit. Peter's grieving. It has nothing to do with you.
Slowly they start after the others.
Perhaps if I just had a bit more time with him.
No, Mr. Barry. That won't be good enough. If a bit more time is all you can provide, you'd better leave him alone.
They walk on, not looking at each other.
I know you don't much care for me, Mrs. DeMaurier, and I respect that. But I loved your daughter very much. And I love those boys. And I think they need me right now.
Is that so? And for how long after?
Meaning what?
Sylvia has requested a co-guardianship for the boys in her will. You, Mr. Barry, and myself.
And what do you have to say about that?
I shall respect my daughter's wishes. Something I should have done more of while she was alive.
Her eyes fill with sadness, but only for a moment.
But if you feel you're not ready for such a commitment, I assure you I can certainly look after the boys by myself.
Do you think I could abandon those boys?
Later, Peter, still in his sober funeral suit and clutching his leather writing book, sits on a bench in Kensington Gardens. He stands up as Barry approaches.
Sit down, Peter.
He does as he's asked, looking up with wide, limpid eyes. Barry sits down next to him. As Barry removes his top hat and leans his furled umbrella against the bench, Peter opens the leather-bound book and shows him the restored pages.
Mother pasted it back together after I ruined it. And then I saw the play. I just started writing. And I haven't been able to stop.
Barry smiles at him.
She would be very pleased to know that. Listen, I just spoken with your grandmother. And I'm staying. For good.
Peter swallows, his eyes starting to film over.
I'm sorry I was so horrible.
Barry shakes his head with a gentle smile.
It's just... I thought she'd always be here.
So did I.
Barry reaches down and takes the book from Peter's lap.
In fact... she is. Because she's on every page of your imagination. We'll always have her there. Always.
He hands back the book. Peter gulps back his tears.
But why did she have to die?
Eyes brimming, he looks searchingly up at Barry, who gazes down at him and shakes his head helplessly as he looks out over the park.
I don't know, boy.
He looks back at Peter, then down at the ground, and a fond smile spreads across his face.
I think of your mother. I will always remember how happy she looked, sitting there in the parlor, watching her play about her family, about her boys that never grew up. She went to Neverland. And you can visit her anytime you like, if you just go there yourself.
Peter swallows hard.
How?
By believing, Peter. Just believe.
Peter looks out over the park, and a tear spills down his cheek. Clutching his book tightly in his hands, Peter's young face crumples. Barry wraps his arms around the boy, who buries his head in the front of Barry's coat, and lets the tears flow. As they rock gently, backwards and forwards, the two figures slowly fade from the scene, leaving just the top hat on the park bench and the furled umbrella propped up against it, with the green lawns, gravel paths, and regimented trees of the park stretching out beyond them. The picture bleaches to white. The end. This audio description was produced by Stephen Dobbin and Veronica Hicks for IMS, copyright 2004. Screenplay by David McGee, produced by Richard N. Gladstein and Nelly Bellflower, directed by Mark Foster. Sir James Matthew Barry was played by Johnny Depp. Sylvia, Llewellyn Davis, Kate Winslet. Mrs. Emma Dumouriez, Julie Christie. Mary Ansel Barry, Rada Mitchell. Charles Frohman, Dustin Hoffman. Peter Llewellyn Davis, Freddie Highmore. Jack Llewellyn Davis, Joe Prospero. George Llewellyn Davis, Nick Rowd. Michael Llewellyn Davis, Luke Spill. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Ian Hart. Peter Pan, Kenny MacDonald. Mr. Jaspers the Usher, Mackenzie Crook. Mrs. Snow, Eileen Essel. Mr. Snow, Jimmy Gardner. Gilbert Cannon, Oliver Fox. Nana, Mr. Riley, Angus Barnett. Smee, Tri Jones. Wendy, Kate Maberly. John, Matt Green. Michael Darling, Catherine Rees. Hook, Lord Something, Tim Potter. Mrs. Darling, Jane Booker. Stage manager, Paul Whitehouse. Sarah, Catherine Cusack. Emma, Carly Peacock. Cottage doctor, Robert Oates. Hospital doctor, Nicholas Pritchard. Dr. Brighton, Jonathan Cullen. Stage worker, Raymond Waring. Theatre patrons Laura Dugood, Seven Stephen, Rosie Eddard, Richard Brain, Tobias Mingis, set mover Tony Way, stagehand Murray MacArthur, with Charlotte Birmingham, Cora Harrison, Jack Birmingham, Sasha Janes, Chelsea Carpenter, Keely James, Luciano Cusack, Stella King, Serafina Cusack, Jake Roach, Claudia Davidson, Molly Whitehouse, Noah Harrison, Sophie Whitehouse, and Eden Harrison, stunt performers Lucy Allen, Paul Heisman. Jim Dowdle, Tony Luckin, Dave Fisher, Danny Powell, Sarah Franzel, and Alan Stewart. Casting by Kate Dowd. Associate producer Tracy Becker. Music by Jan A. P. Kaczmarek. Score recorded and mixed by Rafael Paczkowski. Orchestration by Christopher Hearden, Marek Spakiewicz. Conductor Nick Inman. Concertmaster Cleo Gould. Piano solo Leszek Munster. Boys Choir London Oratory School, Skola. Costume designer Alexandra Byrne. Editor Matt Chess, production designer Gemma Jackson, director of photography Roberto Scheffer, co-producer Michael Dreyer. Executive producers Bob Weinstein, Harvey Weinstein, Michelle Tsai, Gary Binklow, Neil Israel. Location manager Emma Pill. Script supervisor Kathy Doubleday. Art director Peter Russell. Wardrobe supervisor Marion Wise. Chief hair and makeup designer Christine Blundell. Mr. Depp's hair and makeup, Natalie Tessier. Score, production sound mixer David Crozier. Assistant to Mark Foster, Gemma Kern. Transportation coordinator, Gary Birmingham. Post-production supervisor, Corey McCrum-Abdo. First assistant editor, Megan James. Sound editing, Phase UK. Music editor, Christopher Kennedy. Visual effects designer, Kevin Todd Haug. Visual effects producer, Leslie McMinn. Lost Boys Studios. VFX producers, Mark Bennard. Ruler Lenas. Music recording studio, Sony Studios London. Score mixed at Lansdowne Recording Studios London. Peter's song, written by Sir Elton John and Bernie Taupin, performed by Sir Elton John, courtesy of Mercury Records Limited, published by Rouge Booze Inc. and Happenstance Limited. Medieval and Renaissance Fanfare No. 7, composed by David Marshall, published by Studio G Limited. With enormous gratitude to Great Ormond Street Hospital for Children and Kit Palmer, very special thanks to Renee Chabria, Gillian and Colette Chess, Laura Dugood, Michael Emrys, Jane Evans, Laurie Gladstein, Julie Goldstein, John Hadity, James V. Hart, The King Family, Robert Louis Dreyfus, Merrill Poster, Thad Spencer and Ashel Spencer, Ambassador Theatre Group, Richmond Theatre, Virgin Atlantic Airlines. Filmed entirely on location in England and at Shepperton Studios. No animals were harmed in the making of this picture. Copyright 2003 Miramax Film Corp. While this motion picture is based upon a true story, certain characters' names have been changed, some main characters have been composited or invented, and a number of incidents fictionalized. Film Colony. Miramax Films.